Hope in a Hopeless Time. This first meeting, I wanted to be mostly a setup, but I also want to do a little, just tiny bit of biblical reading. And the good news is what we're going to read is something you've already heard today in service. And so, it'll be useful. This is what I would call something like a Bible study plus. It really still will, at the end of the day, most of the weeks, be Bible study in the sense of I actually give you a reading assignment for next time. Not that you have to do it. We'll do it in here. But I want us to always be good readers of text. And I've always approached Feast here at Holy Nativity as being an exercise in reading text. People always ask, Brad, do you take the Bible literally? And my response is usually, well, I at least take it literarily. The Bible is to be read. And to really read it. So you don't get to just quote one verse over here and not know what the whole paragraph was. Okay. You need context. You need to be an educated reader of the Bible.
That's right.
And sometimes I think I'm that. I grew up Baptist, so you had, prior to worship service, which itself lasted a million hours, you had Sunday school.
Yeah.
And so we had an actual, we did the Baptist Training Union standard Bible school lessons. So you would be expected, oh, by grade X, you would have already have read these things and know those things, you know, and stuff like that. And so by the time you were adult, you're supposed to be very, you know, you'd have the adult group that would do the whole, we're going to read the Bible once every year kind of thing. I don't really think, and I don't know if I'm really just saying it to the people I went to church with or if just as a pedagogical model. I don't think, even though they read a lot of the words of the Bible, they didn't read the Bible. They got very good at knowing Scripture, but they didn't read the Bible. They weren't good readers of the Bible. It wasn't until I went to college and started actually taking Bible courses with, you know, biblical scholars, where I actually began to feel like I was actually reading the Bible, reading it for all it was worth. And that's really when I really began to actually value the Bible. When I began to realize it wasn't just these kind of words on high in King James English, but rather this document that came together over a history by communities trying to tell a particular story. So I always try to talk about the Bible in that context. And so that will still be at the heart. I think what's different compared to when I've done Bible study, just straight up Bible study, is this one has an obvious shell. A particular lens through which I've picked the text. In the past, when we've done these, it's really just been, hey, I like the saga of the book of Genesis, and we went week by week on Saturday morning reading chapter by chapter of Genesis, just because when you read it that slowly, it turns into the soap opera it is. You know, you don't get to pass by any of those pointless stories, and so all these stories are beautiful treachery and intrigue and stuff, you know, all the sex, blood, and violence and all of that. It gets quite good. Okay, Hope in a Hopeless Time. So today I want to give a lot of the shell, and then we're going to do a little bit of reading, and then we'll really dive in next time. So what makes our current time hopeless? Because if you don't think it's a hopeless time, then this course doesn't start really well. Some of the conversation about this, I had a conversation with Deacon Scott over beer in our wonderful new Three Weaver brewery in Inglewood. And
what's it called?
Three Weavers.
I've heard. We were just told about it.
Yes, go there. It's become my kind of writing place. It's right by, actually, if you know where the knitting shop is, the knitting shop.
Oh, yeah.
In that triangle of knitting stuff. It's right back there. It's a warehouse, but they have a tasting room. And so we're talking about, I know it sounds so shilling in a certain way, but my newest book that just came out, Introducing Prophetic Pragmatism, written with myself and a good theologian friend of mine, Jacob Goodson. And anytime I can leave LA, I'm usually either in Kentucky with my parents or in Kansas, in Winfield, Kansas, hanging out and enjoying what I call the real America in a certain way. But we wrote this book while I was on sabbatical last. And so last time I was on sabbatical and living in Kansas during sabbatical at his university, we just hammered this book out to kind of deal with a lot of issues we had talked about over the last 15 years. And so this, there's going to be a lot of West in this, I guess is what I'm going to tell you. A lot of Cornel West in this. This is a book on Cornel West. So this is going to be the shell to talk about the blues, maybe ultimately, but to really talk about prophecy and how to fight our current, what I'm calling on this handout, the current age of Pollyannia. Yeah. You had your hand up.
Prophetic pragmatism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, prophetic pragmatism is a philosophical framework. It's the technical name of Cornel West's philosophy. Okay. Continuing the great American philosophical tradition started by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who might indeed, if you don't count Jefferson, the first American philosopher, in the sense of actually articulating America. Mm-hmm. Cornel West sees himself in that tradition. He wants to, of course, link it to the African-American tradition, most of which actually played out theologically and not philosophically. So it's this kind of hybrid view of theology and philosophy, hence why a philosopher and a theologian could write a book together on it. For him, a framework for engaged democratic politics. For us in the academy, more of an actual framework for how to bring together a certain set of philosophical problems. And so usually philosophers don't do politics. And every time a philosopher remotely got close, it didn't end so well. Socrates, blah, blah, blah. So Cornel West, of course, is coming up in the 60s and in grad school in the 70s. He had grown up, although born in Oklahoma, he grew up in Sacramento, California. And, you know, right in the thick of the Black Panther movement and everything. And then he's one of those first Black generations to go to the Ivies. And so he goes to Harvard, graduates in 3 years, goes to Princeton, because that's what you do when you get your bachelor's at Harvard. He goes to Princeton, gets his doctorate, did his coursework within 3 years. It was so impressive to James Cone and Reinhold Niebuhr, if you've heard of that name. He was offered assistant professorship in philosophy of religion at Union Theological Seminary, and he hadn't even defended his dissertation proposal. So he teaches there for 4 years before he writes his dissertation, frankly, because James Cone comes to him and says, "We're going to fire you next year if you do not finish your doctorate." And so Cornel West defends a dissertation on saving Marx from Marxists. So even though we often put Cornel West in that Marxist tradition, he's actually not a Marxist. And then he gets swooped up by Yale Divinity, then a quick stint at Princeton, and then the more famous appointment when Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates Jr., became head of African American Studies at Harvard. He created what was called the Dream Team, him, Kwame Appiah, Toni Morrison, and Cornel West. And so Cornel West has spent his entire life in the Ivy League, as it were. After the Harvard debacle, he just went back to Princeton. In the newest book I'm writing on Cornel West, my joke is, wow, Cornel West proves, if nothing else, what Ivy League still can do. Says those of us who weren't in that. So he's given us some of the undergirding here, and then I've mixed it with just kind of biblical scholarship to boot, but the kind of philosophy under this is prophetic pragmatism. So what makes our current time hopeless? And outside of certain names I'm attributing to West, I'm not saying these are West's views, as it were, but I'm using him as I've assembled this list, and you may feel free to add to this list or subtract from this list. I wanted to give it some kind of headings. So first of all, it seems like there's just a lot of economic hopelessness, and we got to get better at being able to address it. On the one hand, you have economic poverty, which, you know, is the thing we're all kind of looking at in a certain way. We have unemployment, we have underemployment, we have homelessness. California now is the capital of homelessness on the planet. And lack of wealth. So we have ample money moving through our economy, but individual persons outside of Warren Buffett and a few others don't have any wealth. And so it turns out that the average net worth of even white people in the United States is below $100,000. And the average African-American net worth in the United States is $20. So when you subtract, you know, you take asset amount minus debt, and I was going to use my better accounting terms, liabilities, you know, the actual equity of things is $20. Latinos are faring a little better at 30. And so even when we talk about wealth disparity and talking about white people, they're not even that wealthy either. And this is some of the problem. So it's hard to make a case, you know, about diversity based on economics when white people in America are actually poor, comparatively not to other people of the country, but compared to the amount of money they bring home, compared to how much work they have to do for the money they have. In Smiley and West's 2012 book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, which was a report of their poverty tour they made in 2011, which got a lot of bad press because it was critical of the Obama administration. How dare any black person critique Barack Obama?
Although Cornel West did.
Oh, yes. That was what made it scandalous.
I heard that he did.
Yeah. But what I like about the book is they actually talk about the other poverties that are affecting America that's appearing in our economic poverty. And I just listed them here. First of all, poverty of opportunity. What used to be America, the land of opportunity, just no longer really is a land of opportunity. It's just not out there. College students are graduating crippled, already in debt, will never pay it off.
Living at home.
Mm-hmm. There's just nothing out there. There really is nothing out there. What used to be, I posted on Facebook an article just the other day, a person had gone back to their hometown in Arkansas and just, you know, well, what happens when all the factories leave? And of course, this is the story of my hometown in Kentucky just as easily. And the next thing you know, how dare the public library want a new building, right? When everyone's struggling, it's hard to then want a good library or to pay a librarian, right? Because when people look at what they're making, and then they wonder why a person who sits with books all day is going to want even more money than the more money they make than the people in the city. So poverty opportunity is real. And it's one of the things we forget to talk about when we talk about economic poverty. Mm-hmm. Second is the poverty of affirmation. We're an American culture that doesn't own up to anything. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we can't even affirm the causes of poverty or the causes of the economic disbalance amongst groups in America. But it also means the poverty of affirmation. We've just become a sour critical culture. The grand American meliorism, as it was called, the belief that America could just always infinitely get better and better and better, you know, has ended. And I actually pinned that to 1989. I mean, the fall of the Berlin Wall is ironically a real world event, but maybe in a more negative way than we often depict it. It was kind of the end of the need to get better. So when you look at American history during the Cold War, you have a clear, obvious competitor, but those two competitors had similar values in a certain way. And so things like the investment in science and technologies and what have you. Meanwhile, the newest kind of world competitor is running on a completely different model than the United States. The Chinese model is not the American model, and it's not the Soviet one. And so it's the end of Europe, I'll just leave it at that. So how do we affirm and think about improvements when actually the entirety of the West is coming to an end? And of course, this was predicted even as early as 1930. You have Otto Spengler, you have Martin Heidegger in the philosophical world, the end of the West, and we're in that moment. We also have a poverty of courage. Since I don't have much as an average American, I'm not going to risk much. But that also then means I can't stand up against oppression or tyranny or anything, because at the end of the day, we just don't have it. And Vietnam taught us, you know, if I'm going to expend lives, I better be right. And although that's true, it also means we don't risk anymore. We're not as willing to just send people off in the same ways. In a certain way. But that also then means a lack of courage at home and in our communities as well.
Well, when people just don't have very much, then
then you're just not going to risk very much because you have like, because if you don't win, you fall off the cliff.
Right. No, that's exactly the problem.
Too much to lose.
Too much to lose. Yep. Poverty of compassion, which is actually kin to this, right? If we are getting colder and colder and less compassionate, it's literally because our lives in a certain way have gotten so impoverished that we just can't afford friendliness to our neighbors. We can't afford the risk of vulnerabilities or generosity, right? I have to make certain choices. Going back to this article I just read the other day, right? So the town in Arkansas doesn't want this new tax, a property tax, which most of the people in the county wouldn't even pay this additional amount. It's for anyone whose farm, basically, in this area is worth more than $200,000. That affects two people in the whole area. And those two people are even willing to pay it. Mm-hmm. But the idea of raising taxes that might someday come back to bite us, because the whole library problem was we used to be this big natural gas thing, and that's when we built that library to begin with, and then we lost that. Mm-hmm. And so it would just be an unsustainable tax base for the future. Mm-hmm. And so we actually kind of, in order to not have to face things, we turn off our compassion. And I'll just assume that I can get my kids enough books, for example, was one of the arguments. You know, we'll just buy books for our own children. We don't need a public library. And so along with this, poverty compassion is a poverty community, insofar as we have to become more and more individual in order to make it, to literally make it. And then, of course, poverty of imagination. So, for example, we live in a world that a lot of our problems are the result, dare we say, of technology, and we think that the solution is a different technology. Right, and so we just stay stuck in the same, well, maybe we just did more of what we did that got us into this mess. And so, you know, I always tell students, climate change denial is quite easy to explain at the end of the day, right? It's just, okay, we just presuppose that Exxon is going to come up with something we're going to shoot into the atmosphere 15 years from now, and it's going to soak up all this CO2. That's what we're actually betting on. We're actually betting on a technical solution to the environmental crisis. Mm-hmm. Let's hurry up and get Mars inhabitable. Mm-hmm. Let's hurry up and figure out how to build our buildings to withstand massive rainfall. Right. Da, da, da.
Accepting.
Right. Accepting. Versus maybe this just actually is the result of our very own technological innovations. Yeah. So that would be the poverty, underneath poverty. And the argument to eradicate poverty is we have to get rid of all of these poverties, along with the economic poverty. Yeah.
You know what I was going to say is that it's funny, I see the list, and so what I would say is that there's people who have, and there's plenty of those around, mm-hmm. as far as, like, around here, you know, maybe not Kentucky. But if you look at those who have, then they are also kind of unwilling to do these things.
Right.
Because these things would mean that they would not have as much.
Right.
So they also are not about being mm-hmm. courageous or compassionate or imaginative and mm-hmm. all these things. They have a poverty of it because they want to remain being the winners.
Right.
And so if they get creative or compassionate or something, it might mean that they have to change or change and then not have as much.
Or you take a risk and you become... And you don't have it anymore.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying even those people who I think are really firmly economically well...
Right. Are we see impoverished.
As far as compassion goes and imagination and courage and stuff, because they don't want to change their situation.
Right.
So for other reasons, they're impoverished in these areas, which is very interesting.
It's a zero-sum mindset.
Right.
That if I'm going to, you know, if I'm going to diminish my wealth, and some, you know, or if somebody else is going to improve theirs, then mine is going to be reduced.
Correct.
And that's a zero-sum mindset.
I guess my bigger worry is that the thing we win at the end of that isn't something anyone wants to win is going to be the problem, right? So, you know, we're going to reach what in philosophy of technology is called the unmakeable. Moore's law about technological improvement is reaching asymptotic land. You know, at best, we're just going to keep getting bigger and bigger televisions. Or very, very tiny things, right? So everything's now, things are going to get bigger or smaller. We've kind of gotten to the wall of how faster I can make an electron move through a wire. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the solution to our problem might be one step over, but it's just unmakeable. And we'll see what would solve it, but not be able to make it. It's going to be that kind of problem. And at that moment, as it were, what will our wealth be able to do? And the answer is nothing. Right? And that's going to be the issue philosophically perceived. So that would be economic hopelessness. And feel free, you know, in their discussion, we can talk more about that. There's also political hopelessness that we're in the middle of. And we've been in for quite some time, actually. I'm very clear with people. Trump is a symptom, not the cause. So we have to actually diagnose the illness, right? And not its skin surface manifestation. Cornel West calls this in his book Democracy Matters the deterioration of democratic powers. We've actually just given up on democracy. And you hear this a lot with Republicans, particularly, at least the ones I interact with a lot. Anytime you say the word democracy, they remind you that we are a republic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, were you going to war in Iraq to spread republics? No, America has always said we were bringing democracy to the world and fighting against the evil communists because they're a threat to democracy. And of course, the problem is now the word democracy sounds too much like Democrat, and therefore we now want to disassociate from it. But that's very problematic, and at least it's problematic not because we can decide whether or not to be a democracy. It's just that if we have decided not to be a democracy anymore, we need to decide what we are instead of that. And what we... So there's three ways that West talks about this. First of all, we have free market fundamentalism. As Naomi Klein wonderfully says about environment, you know, we're more able to imagine the end of the planet than the end of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be our problem. I can actually imagine the end of the habitability of the Earth more than the end of the free market. And as a result, we are politically hopeless. There's no people's movement that can outbeat the market, right? So even if, let's say, a major corporation decided it wanted to do something about the environment, it would just lose all of its market share and then be unable to do it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have that problem. Same thing, you know, a quick aside, you know, we talk about prison industrial complex a lot, and I'm definitely against it. There's also the reality of, okay, if I close every prison in America, we increase unemployment in the United States by 1 million-plus people. We're actually feeding our children on this. And that's what makes it hard to get rid of. Because when counties like mine lose the factory, what comes in is private prison, and then employs the people in the town to work at the jail instead of the factory. And so we need more prisoners because we got to be able to keep these prisons operating.
But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't stop.
Of course, no. Oh, no, of course. I'm just pointing out the free market fundamentalism that keeps that from happening so easily.
But it's a lack of critical thinking and
imagination. Of course.
100 years ago, we had, what, a third of the people working in farms?
Mm-hmm.
And now we have, what, 1%? People working in farms,
true.
Getting far more people.
Capitalism.
It can be done.
It can be done. Yeah. We have aggressive militarism. You know, one of the problems of the 20th century of the United States was to actually become, as it were, the diplomat of democracy, but it then put us into a world scenario that America, in at least the 19th century, was trying very hard to not be in. Right? The whole point was America was to become distinct from Europe, and then next thing you know, you're into World Wars and in NATO, et cetera, and we're back to the North Atlantic problem, as it's generally called by Paul Gilroy. This causes us to have to be more militaristic than America itself wants to be. And so we don't get to decide anymore where we're going to spend military energy. Just to name some current names, you know, North Korea, you have ISIS. The war machine is on, and it's simply what role do we play inside of a growing world war where war can happen at any moment of the planet at any time. And then third, an escalating authoritarianism. right? If we have a decrease in democratic powers, you've got to make up for that in bureaucracy. And so right now, the United States government is the number one employer of Americans. The state itself is the number one employer.
Yep.
Because in the lieu of local politics and in lieu of neighborly activity, what have you, someone's got to still do things. And we see that. Sheldon Wolin, who was Cornell West's dissertation director, actually calls this inverted totalitarianism. So instead of kind of moving upward to the one authoritarian leader, what we have is actually the diffusal of state power into every tiny pocket. Right? So in China, you have the party in Beijing, but you know, I go give a lecture, on the surface we have to follow certain rules. Where I'm having dinner, envelopes are being thrown into my lap under the table, because you can only reimburse certain things for international scholars, but a school will want you to have money to have covered the other things. And so the very dean is like sticking, you know, unmarked bills in envelopes and giving them to you when you're giving lectures in China. Or my favorite example of this, if you're ever in Beijing and the light is red and the sign says don't walk, meanwhile, 500,000 Chinese people are crossing the road anyway, and you have one police officer at the intersector blowing a whistle.
Wow.
We've done the inverse of that, where we're now much more interested on the daily minutiae and then not actually caring about what's happening in Washington at all. And so he calls that an inverted totalitarianism. We have a gridlock of the two-party system. We are now literally in the gridlock of two-party system. And it has governed American politics pretty much since the late 70s. And we have the polemics of contemporary discourse. The blessing of social media is, boy, you can contact anyone and communicate any idea. The bad news is you can contact anyone and communicate any idea. They did a study that shows that pretty much there are two separate Facebooks going on in America, since people tend to like people who think like them and unfriend people they disagree with. You just actually get one meme world happening over here and one meme world happening over there. And so where everyone was saying, hooray, we're already ready to celebrate the Hillary Clinton victory in one of those spheres, the other sphere was saying, let them think they win until we get off from work at 5, and then we are going to flood the polls. And since the two spheres don't talk to each other, you actually had the Trump plan happening right there on social media. But the liberal world doesn't listen to that part of the social media world, and therefore it came as a surprise on election night. But actually, this has been the talk in that circle for quite some time about exactly how it was going to happen and to make sure it looked like she was going to win. So it was done in spite. There was a real plan there. And so the polemic, simply meaning fighting for winning and not for truth, right? In philosophy, we want the truth, not to win, allegedly. And so that causes all of our political hopelessness we find ourselves in right now. We also have a spiritual hopelessness, and I'm treading on thinner ice. I went with the thing that everyone would probably agree with me on to something people would find maybe more annoying. And now to this third level, there's also just a spiritual hopelessness. Even if America was at least at best hypocritical in its religious application of its own religious ideas, we are seeing a wane in spirituality in the United States. Or I should better say, it's being replaced with a different kind of spirituality, but not of a religious sort. We see this in the rise of the nuns. And the prediction is by 2075, the nuns will be the largest religious group actually in America. Now, on the one hand, you can say, hooray, secular society finally achieved. Bad news is, you can't be Martin Luther King in that America. Martin Luther King's arguments only work in an America that saw itself holding certain Christian values. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Yeah. We're also seeing the rise in political fundamentalism in these nuns. And so the new arguments against gay rights or against multiculturalism and inclusion and things like that are actually coming from atheism. You know, people who would have otherwise no other religious affiliation have now appropriated the discourse and gotten, they've saved you know, kind of white supremacist language from its faulty religious undertones. But now just pure power moves versus feelings of theological backing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So once you have the nuns, the problem is you can't then replace that with, you know, it used to be when you're dealing with old white supremacists, you would just replace their God talk with the right God talk. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to do that with nuns because the God talk is already broken. We have the increase in human mortality rates, says Deacon Scott mentioned today. And, of course, the drug epidemic, especially in rural America, where in my hometown, people will now actually shoot up in front of the hospital because they're so afraid.
Die.
Yeah, that they might die. At least if they're in front of the hospital, someone will find them and perhaps save their life. I gave a sermon many years ago when my hometown decided to go wet. For those who've always been out in California, wet means you can now sell alcohol. And growing up, this was always on the ballot, but the preachers would get into town square and do a revival for the town, and, you know, we're not going to do this. But when they tried to do that this time, a lot of the people simply said, we're not going to come to the revival because we know your daughter's on drugs, Pastor. Mm-hmm. And so that's not a moral high ground anymore. Yeah. And so always, you know, I'm like, gee, I don't lament my home county going wet because I have a view about drinking. It's just that the argument to do so was so sad. It was just, well, we're all addicted to drugs, so we might as well drink.
Maybe alcohol is better than drugs.
Than drugs, yeah. And that's a weird playoff compared to what the argument used to be. And then what I've now called fragility in all its forms, be that, you know, toxic masculinity or everyone being so offended and things like that. We've lost, and this is the scandalous sentence of the day, and every time I teach I have what I call the scandalous sentence of the day. America's lost its grit. Now, somewhere we were told to try to get rid of that grit, right? Because there are problems associated with that grit. But now we don't have any grit. And so the idea that we respond to things might literally be to tough them out is off the table. Right. And this is going to be problematic in a hopeless time. Mm-hmm. Because hope is going to require us to have to endure and bear certain things. Let's collectively call this, as I called it the other day in my sermon, nihilism. And there's three main forms, according to Cornel West, of nihilism. One, you have evangelical nihilism. This is the flight of religious people. So the rise in evangelical fundamentalism in America is actually not a theological issue. It's the response to an emotional state of people. Since there's nothing to keep them, as it were, off of drugs, they become radically religious. And then religion just is the drug in that sense. So that would be like evangelical nihilism. So megachurches are growing, growing, growing. What really they represent is the need for community.
Right.
Right. It's not that this preacher with their beautiful, you know, perfect teeth are, you know, actually giving them anything of substance. I'm sorry if you're fans of this particular person I have in my head, but everyone who knows me long enough knows I have a running rivalry against Joel Osteen. Because he says nothing.
Right.
He is beautiful, though. My goodness, I need to get my teeth worked on. But everyone's allowed to stay fragile. And he'll just give you, you know. And so this is truest the Feuerbachian, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses problem. The opiate of the masses was never meant to be that people are stupid. It's literally opiate. Literally, how to numb, how to ease the pain. And so most of the super religious fanatics in America are actually in pain. Yeah. And we need to tell that story about them in a certain way. Second, you have paternalistic nihilism. This is connected to the increase in bureaucracy and government control. So the paternalistic nihilism says, look, the average American is no longer able to take care of themselves in the following regards, and therefore we need to do that. So I need these standards for education because no, you know, intelligent people in any local community can actually teach the kids. We see a massive problem in America, of course, a teacher shortage, but also teachers no longer being in the communities they teach. Meanwhile, at least in segregated America, everybody in the black neighborhood knew the black teachers because the black teachers literally lived in that neighborhood and taught those kids for decades. My mother and my grandmother had the same teacher, to put that into perspective. And so a paternalistic nihilism is what the government then responds with, in the sense of, okay, so we'll just take care of that. And then you won't have to worry about it. But of course, the more things the government then takes care of that you don't then have to worry about, the less likely you will then handle anything.
Invest.
And so it actually turns into a nihilism. Yeah. The thing we're not thinking of when we say we could be more like Finland or, you know, Scandinavia in general, is that they built their governments, as it were, with the point of view of, we're going to take care of healthcare, and then these are the things our citizens would then be able to do since health won't be in their way. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, we're trying to say, well, we just need the healthcare, but we don't have an argument for why people need health.
Right.
There's not the, now that health care is out of the way, what will these people now then be doing? And that's what we don't have. So we talk about education will solve all these problems. But if you're getting educated and there's no jobs out there, if there's no, you know, that nations that have top-notch education systems also then have a plan about what happens to people after they get educated. You know, so we got to be careful with a paternalistic nihilism that has all the solutions, but then there's nothing to then do. To merely stay alive, after all, is not health. Yeah.
I have a question. And this has come, I've seen this, but it's coming up for me now more and more as I see personal clients, young and older and everything, is that, and I don't know if it falls in the spiritual hopelessness or the nihilism or whatever, it's just nobody really has kind of these underlying like values or purpose. It's like that existential thing is totally missing. So they're not really sure why. You know, the why is so gone. And I talk to young people, too, that are just depressed. They're doing work they don't like or whatever. And it's like, well, what do we want your life to look like? Who are your heroes? And they look at me like, what are you talking about?
Right.
You know, they don't know what that means. And,
right.
You know, so it's like even older people, like the purpose, the existential meaning for getting up in the morning or what values you might work towards is so lacking now that... You know, that's it leads to maybe a spiritual hopelessness or a nihilism or whatever, but yeah, that's just good. Such a...
Yeah.
Like, we have, like, such an existential crisis in this country.
No, I would agree with you there. Mm-hmm. And to follow on that, that third thing, the sentimental nihilism, where you either just wish you could go back to a time that didn't feel so nihilistic, or you actually hope for the end of the world. So some of the climate issue... read existentially, is that it's also a form of suicide, right? To actually bring an end. And there are those who want an end of the world.
It's a huge piece
way.
In the New Yorker, exactly like that, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really? Give me the reference.
It was basically saying, like, what if we just face the fact that we're doomed and basically give up? But, of course, he's 60, so he won't live through the absolute worst of it. But it's really nice for him to just give up and not do anything.
Right.
So, whether or not you check the, like, actual, in the climate world, they say denialism or de, and then nihilism, because whether or not you don't believe it or don't do anything about it, you end up in the same place.
Right. Right. So, I wanted to just say that because, you know, one of the things that prophecy as a tradition tries to do is actually paint the present picture. So when you read even the book of Revelation, you got to think first century Christianity in the Roman Empire. That is the painting being painted. The book of Daniel is going to be the Babylonian captivity, things like that. So if we're going to try to read prophetic scripture for today's time, we have to say what is happening in this time. So this is not meant to be a definitive list. These are the things I think of when I think, why do I say I'm in a hopeless, God-forsaken world? Or to use the name of Martin Luther King's sermon he was writing to give the next day in Memphis, if he hadn't been shot, why America is going to hell. And I think these are some of the things that we at least need to address. You can add things to this list, of course. You can disagree with me on what's on this list. This is just me thinking about what is my present time? What is the hopelessness I'm thinking of when I preach hope in a hopeless time? These are the things. In the American context. The good news about reading scripture is you realize that this is not new and that people have always been preaching and proclaiming against their present time. And so the period of the lectionary we're in right now is what I'm calling a biblical hopeless time. And it has to do with the fall of Israel and Judah. Now, I gave you this handout with the timeline. And, you know, this basically is the plot of characters of 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, and 2nd Chronicles. So the history books, the big parts of the history books of the Old Testament. So you have Saul, 1st King. Prior to that, you had the judges, right? There was no one exact ruler, but you had the one that could resolve disputes. But everyone else was getting had kings, and the people of Israel demanded, we want a king, we want a king, we want a king. Samuel goes to God, like, well, they want a king, and God says, well, sometimes I'll give people what they wish for. And so they get a king, and that king is Saul, and he's not really a good one. David becomes king, and that's kind of the establishment of kind of what we would call the theocracy. He has, you know, several sons who die in a variety of ways. And Solomon is the third king of Israel. And he has two children who get into war with each other upon Solomon's death. And the kingdom divides into two. So you have the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And that forms the kingdom of Judah overall. And you have Israel, which are the other 10 of the 12 tribes. The northern kingdom, as it's sometimes called, and then the southern kingdom. Now, you immediately see, and you know, I'm not going to talk about all these characters, but if you look at the Israel on the right-hand side, all bad rulers. Mm-hmm. And so they fall earlier. There's no redemption, falls into idolatry. They are taken over by the Assyrians. You hear that story in 2 Chronicles. No, 2 Kings. I should say something real quick about that. So 1st and 2nd Samuel really are the stories about Saul, David, Solomon. And then 1st and 2nd Kings are the stories of the two kingdoms. And then 1st and 2nd Chronicles retells you that entire story all over again. And so 1st and 2nd Chronicles is like the abridged, accelerated story of what happened in 1st, 2nd Kings, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. So there you have it. The assumption is that the writer of 1st and 2nd Chronicles is Jeremiah, hence why I had to bring that up. So, Israel falls. Judah hangs on longer, and some people would argue, because there were some good rulers, and there were actual efforts in Judah. Judah had the responsibility because, of course, Jerusalem is in Judah, is in the kingdom of Judah. And so you have this need to... there was more of an obvious reminder. You had the prophets, you had the priests there, you know, versus Northern Kingdom in a certain way. You have some good kings. Ones that are highly praised in the tradition are kings like Joash and Uzziah. You get someone like Manasseh, who was a bad ruler, but then repents and gets a good reign out of that. Josiah, as I mentioned in my sermon the other day, was the last king who actually tried to lead repentance in Judah. But by that moment, these you know major prophets, as we'd say, Daniel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, are already foretelling the collapse of Judah. And that does happen at the hands of the Babylonian Empire. And as we'll see in a couple of weeks when we read the book of Daniel, everyone then finds themselves under the rule of one Nebuchadnezzar. Mm-hmm. A name that I always have to type it and wait until the squiggly tells me how to do it. That's all I kind of want to say about that timeline. You may, of course, feel free to read 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings and stuff if you are gripped. Usually I suggest right here this particular retelling of the Bible called Testament. And I forgot who did it, but it tries to tell all these stories in a more novel, like a novel. Like if you're writing a historical novel. Versus the scriptural. And it does a pretty good job at telling you kind of that story of the two kingdoms and stuff. It doesn't, now Testament is not trying to actually translate the Bible, so it's not like the message in that regard. Peterson stays with the actual structure of the Bible. Testament does not. Our Old Testament work coming up is going to be on the prophecy that's produced in the period of Babylonian captivity. So Jeremiah has the witness, the fall of Judah. And next time we're going to start there. We're going to read a couple chapters of Jeremiah, the beginning chapters, and then two of the Lamentations. Jeremiah wrote both of those. To properly mourn the fall of Jerusalem. Now, to be clear, I mean, this the reestablishment of Jerusalem would come about 100 years later, and you start then getting the establishment of the Sanhedrin and things like that. So this is a period, and it comes out the other end. So just as the prophet will say, God will still be faithful, la, la, la. But it's going to take generations. And so the worry about hopeless times is we also live in a world that thinks that the solution to a hopeless situation will occur tomorrow. And the prophets seem to suggest they will always take these big kind of historical periods of time. And so to keep faith, even when in your entire lifetime there was no hope and no hope on the other end, as it were. We'll then move on to the book of Daniel. And the setting of the beginning of the book of Daniel is the court of Nebuchadnezzar, right? There's three Hebrew boys, you know, who are in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. And we hear the story of them. And then this one dude that is imprisoned but can see the writing on the walls, literally. And then Ezekiel is more properly diasporic. He's the prophet who's in the Valley of the Dry Bones, in the period before getting back to Jerusalem. And we'll talk about him. Questions or comments about that structure, at least in the Old Testament part? When we get to the New Testament, there's going to be a little different view because the idea of time changes between the two testaments. So for the Old Testament prophets, if you never get back to Jerusalem, it's game over in a certain way. Christianity will have a different approach. We have kind of the end of time, as it were. For the Jews, there's no such thing. So either you get back to Jerusalem or you don't. So I spent a lot of time talking about hopelessness. I want to now say something about hope so that when we go through these weeks, we have the right kind of view of hope. And Cornel West calls this kind of hope prophetic hope. Sometimes he calls this hope on a tightrope. It's a hope that is not Pollyannish. And so Pollyannish is, of course, this kind of super optimism, the pie in the sky optimism, utopian dreams, the hope that just if everyone would read more books, we would not be in the age of Trump, or, Michael Moore, you know, for better or worse, you know, whatever you think about him, said a very stupid thing once. When George Bush was reelected, he actually said, gee, if only more people had gone to see Fahrenheit 9/11, or if I'd put a few more scenes, I had some stuff I should have put in there. I'm like, sorry, Michael Moore, you could have... I mean, we see it right now. You can literally have the documents and transcripts of phone calls. That's not our problem. Right. It's not information. Right. This is why I always get mad when people say, well, people are just ignorant. No, we actually live in a world where everyone knows everything. This is some, maybe, of our problem. But also, Right. Everybody knows, actually. Right? That's the catch. It's not that the people who are denying climate change actually aren't noticing climate change. It's just that some of them are actually welcoming it. And we got to get blunter about what that behavior is. Instead of saying ignorance, it's not ignorance. Everybody knows. Everyone notices as well. Cornel West plays out three elements of prophetic hope. First of all, there's Socratic questioning. We got to ask questions to get the truth of the matter versus questions that are merely rhetorical or lead to empowerment of particular political goals. So as long as we treat the question of climate change as something the Democratic Party is more interested in than the Republicans, it will continue to force Republicans, regardless of their education, to deny climate change because they're just wanting to be anti-Democrats in a certain way. There are a lot of issues in America that are issues for everybody, but we've ascribed them to particular parties, and then I start taking up positions more because of the party I'm in. Not, I hold these positions, so let me think about what party to join. It's, I'm already in this party, so now I have to hold these positions. But we need Socratic questioning to get around that.
Right. or just politicization of of issues that don't need to be ascribed to one party or the other.
Right. Everyone should want to mitigate the suffering of poverty.
Yeah.
But we've oddly made that sound like something Democrats do. Second would be the prophetic tradition itself, right? For Cornell West, there is no mere secular solution to the problem of nihilism. It has to have a spiritual component. This prophetic tradition, he thinks, has played out in two ways that make the most sense in America. One is, of course, the Judaic prophetic story as expressed in the Old Testament and fulfilled within the New Testament. And the other is the history of black people in America. Those are your two kind of prophetic traditions that undergird prophetic pragmatism. I don't suggest that that limits, we can have other things, but those are two clear stories in America. So if you really want to tell a story of Americans holding on and still having grit and what have you, well, there's the story of these strange creatures called the black people. In America, who had no reason to stay alive, but chose to do so, and did so with no promise or guarantee at all that the risk for freedom would be worth it. As I always joke, the weirdest thing in the universe is that somehow black people believed in America, and really did. And then against anyone else wanting it, they're like, nope, we're just going to do it now. Okay, now I am American, and I'm going to be your culture now. You know, I always joke when I teach African American studies, right? I appreciate that certain white people have correctly figured out that there's this weird way in which black people kind of just elbowed themselves in and just joined the American world. That's a moment of hope, right? And so we can be in weird situations and still come up with something because black people have already shown us, as it were, that you could do that. So that's the prophetic traditions, at least as West thinks of it. I just want to point out, it's not a mere political problem, right? Since some of the problem is spiritual, I need an actual part of hope that is spiritual in a certain way. And if black people, after all, had not latched on to the prophetic of the Old Testament, then they wouldn't be prophetic either. So ultimately, the richness, at least, of our Western culture, of the prophetic tradition, is in this story of the prophets in the Old Testament. And then third, we have tragicomic hope. This is a hope that can't be pie in the sky because it has to be gritty and into the realities of our world. So my favorite example of tragicomic hope would be blues music. It also appears in country music, but that's because country music itself also comes from the blues. That we have to somehow find a way to mock the suffering that we have. We have to find a way to put it into a context and then try to find joy given that. But it cannot be a hope that the suffering or its causes disappear. So our current world wants us to never be tragic. And so we have a million different distractionary items and practices. You know, we'll watch too much TV or we'll pretend that we're watching news, but we really don't have news on American television. And I remember, an essay of mine that picked up some traction at the time was called Glenn Beck and the Order of Discourse, where I pointed out that a lot of the people, of course, who were critical of Glenn Beck for being a clownish buffoon who was not actually a political scientist or, anything like that, swore by the Daily Show, hosted by an actual buffoon in the sense of being a comedian. and I was like, so somewhere we don't have any news. It's all the show and it's all entertainment. And it's kind of like the way we talk about fitness as a hobby in America, which no one else on the planet understands. Why in America do you have people who say one of their hobbies is fitness? for the French, it would just be solved by good gastronomy, or something like that. But, we have this weird way where, since I can't say anything, I'll just work on my body. And you hear people say, no, you see, Brad, I've done a lot of work on my body. Yes, You know, this is all we can work on. Can't work on our society. Can't work on society. Just make sure, as Oscinus, Oxford theologian, whatever he says, so we wind up with fit bodies and fat minds, you know. It's, but the tragicomic knows that life is hard. It knows that Christianity entered a world that was desperate and difficult. It's what Reinhold Niebuhr calls strenuous mood, right? And so Cornel West says that prophetic hope is strenuous mooded. It's not pessimistic, because it does believe at the end the kingdom of God is established. But it's honest about how much stuff you're going to have to go through to establish it. So if the kingdom of God is negating a lot of this nihilistic stuff, we have a lot of it. And so when students ask me, you know, in the context of like African-American studies, oh, well, how soon do you think America could be post-racial? And my usual answer is, well, 2419. If the planet holds. Right? It did take 400 years to get to this moment. It really did. Right? And so to mysteriously just think, oh, if I vote for a particular person in an election, that's going to undo 400 years of work. I've got to actually chip, and it's sclerotic, right? So, you know, it's hardened up, it's fused with the world. So I've got to chip, and then just chip and chip and chip, and that's going to take a lot of time. And every day we're not doing that,
right,
we're pushing 400 years further. I see. Yes. So I'm going to leave it to you to look at this passage you heard today in the Psalter from Lamentation. Now, this is convenient because if you were puzzled this morning, wait a minute, a psalm goes here. Well, luckily, this is also a poem. And you heard this today. This was today's reading. I wanted to emphasize the idea of waiting. But I want it to be clear that this waiting is not quiet. He says quiet, but it goes on with a different theme. But our waiting is not quiet. We need what West calls revolutionary patience. I have to be willing to wait to see it through. It's not passive. It's not, oh, I'll just wait on the Lord, and the Lord will someday convince Congress to do something. No, you know, this is a long-term thing. What we're waiting on is the fulfillment of God's plan, not that God's going to come and make life easy or something like that. And then in the meanwhile, we have to have active resistance. We got to actually chip away at things. We have to realize that God's faithfulness actually includes punishing wickedness. I know we hate that. I know we hate that in today's, you know, kind of religious scene. We don't like talking much about God's judgment of things. But this is exactly the situation that Israel and Judah faced, and it's the one we are facing. God does punish Judah and Israel, and Jeremiah just has to watch and just has to then endure it. And same thing would happen to the first century Christians. The same thing is going to happen to Jews in the diaspora. And we're going to have to be, we're not spared from the side effects of it. And then third, I put here, if one has hope in God and God's justice, then there would be no counterclaim that God should not have allowed the wickedness of people to lead to their own ruin. So what happens to Judah and Israel is not God all of a sudden deciding to be an unloving, unmerciful God. As I mentioned a couple weeks ago, God gave centuries of warnings. So as the scripture always says, God is slow to anger. You know, hundreds of years of idolatry of Israel. Not a single good king. But it still took two centuries for Israel to fall. And so here we are in the 243rd year of the United States of America, the 400th proper year of kind of black people in America, so kind of the early colonial America, and then 243 years of this. Has America, one question, you know, kind of not meant as a political question, but as a prophetic one, has America reached its expiration of godlessness? Does God continue to hold out for America to finally be a Christian nation, perhaps for the very first time, or is it now too late? And are we now just seeing the decline that comes with unrighteousness? I pose that not so much as a Baptist hellfire brimstone point, but as a question while we're reading prophets. So even in the book of Revelation, the world has to be destroyed. The kingdoms of the world in Daniel will crumble. And all of these prophets, even though they remind Israel and Judah that this is due to what they did, they then also will point out that, of course, Babylon is going to fall. Assyria is also going to fall. So it's not that God has automatically now picked the Assyrians and the Babylonians to be the blessed people. That's not what happens. Rather, God will use an already failing civilization, dare we say, in response to the failures of God's people. And so God doesn't, for example, help Babylon stay in business any longer. It's just that Israel might as well join the general decline of the world at that time. And so they're now in the Babylonian Empire that itself is in decline even at this moment of taking over Israel. Okay, I'm out of time. You can read the rest of the handout there. Next time we're going to be a little more textual, but still bring particularly questions about application. Oh, I read this passage and I'm hearing this in it. And how do I, you know, as I tell students, questions of the form, how do I, ... So I'm focused right on the beginning poem of the book of Jeremiah. It goes over several chapters, but it's one big poem. And then Lamentations 2 and 3. 1, 2, 4, and 5 of Lamentations are all true lamentations. Nothing good happens in them at all. They describe the destitution of Israel. In the middle, there's a double, twice as long as all the others. They're all acrostics. And the third one is two sets of acrostics. And there we get the moment of hope. But we're still going to have to go through generations of captivity, even as the hope is being prophesied. And so we'll look at that. And you can see, I quoted Shulman here, the four things that prophets do. They announce, they bear witness, they forewarn. But most interesting, and the reason I've picked kind of the passages we're going to read, they sing and poeticize. And so I'm really focusing on the poems of these texts this go-around. They sing the blues. And I'm going to focus on that. So, for example, Revelation, we're not going to be as interested in giant lizards falling from the sky, but the neat poetics used to talk about them. Okay, let's end there.